got a mission project coming up next week. In fact, I leave next Sunday to begin setting that up. And then a group of high school seniors from a Catholic high school in Kansas City area is going to come out on the 11th. And we're going to do a project out on the Navajo Reservation. And I had it all set, man, nailed down, knew what I was going to do. I had three potential projects up around Shonto and Inscription House. And, you know, I like to have things well prepared, been working on them well in advance. One thing I didn't plan on was record-breaking snow, though. And when I got there, you know, they sent me an email that says, I don't think this is going to work, John, because, man, we're getting snowed in. In fact, the gym, the roof of the gym caved in from the snow load at the school we stay at in the summertime. So I needed to find a plan B. And, you know, God always does this to me. I tell people this is going to be a stretching experience for you, but it always is for me too, because there's always these little monkey wrenches in the gearbox. And I did it again. Here we go. And so as I was visiting with people, I stopped by a pastor in Sanders, Arizona. He's just off the reservation, but it's a native church. And his father-in-law is Lemuel Yazzie. You can see him up there. He is a World War II code talker with the Marine Corps. And I was just reading about them just this last week, and I can't remember the number. It's either there's only 13 left or 30 left out of the original 300 and some that were in the Pacific Theater. And he's one of the last ones left. And his health has been going down. I've known him for quite a few years. In fact, one of the first projects we did at a little church called Sebiotzil was to fix his bathroom. They had almost a 2-foot step up into the bathroom, and these people are in their late 80s, and it was very dangerous. And as it turned out, before we were able to get there and get the project done, his wife actually fell and broke her hip and never did recover from it. But we did get it done, so he's been living there off and on. But the last couple of years, his health has really, really been going down fast. He's probably 92, 93 years old and going down fast. And he's living with his daughter now in Sanders. So I was talking to his son-in-law, who's the pastor there, and, you know, asking him how Lemuel is doing and that. And he said, you know, he's not doing too good. They're probably not going to treat him much more. And really, the only thing he really wants is to die at home. He doesn't want to die at our place in Sanders. He wants to go back home, and he wants to die there. But there's not his house is too small for anybody to really live there with him. But they have a little hogan not too far from his house that is all dried in, but it needs to be finished. It needs the interior and the insulation and some things like that put in there and a stove. And then his daughter, Linda, will be able to move in there and take him back home so that he can live out what days left he has on this earth at home and die at home. So that's going to be our project. That's what God kind of threw out of the blue there. Wasn't even really planning on stopping by Sanders, but we said, well, we're here. It's about the right time. Let's go check out Jerry, and that's what we got. So that's going to be our project. So thank you for praying for us, and I'll be getting ready for that. This week, be leaving next Sunday, but it was really quite a road trip. I flew from Reno to Kansas City, and then did 2 days of pre-field orientation with the leaders, and then the high school students that are going to be coming out next week. And then I flew back to Phoenix and met up with a friend of mine who is with the mission with me. And then we rented a 4-wheel drive Suburban, fortunately. It was 4-wheel drive, and drove to Albuquerque, visited with some Pueblo leaders I'm working with, and then up to Raton, and then, oh man, Sanders and Holbrook and just a whole bunch of towns. I mean, I was having a hard time keeping track of what day it was even, and checking things out and kind of getting ready for projects and that. But I flew from Kansas City to Phoenix, where I met up with Aaron, and we drove from there. But when I flew into Phoenix, I did my normal routine after getting off an airplane. I get off the plane as quick as I can, and I head straight for the bathroom because, you know, let's face it, I'm over 60, and I was barely sitting down when I heard a voice from the other stall say, "Hi, how you doing?" I thought that was kind of strange. I'm not, you know, a real chatty Cathy by nature anyway. And I can guarantee you, bathroom conversations are definitely off the table. I just don't go there. It's not cool. So don't even say hi to me in the bathroom, guys. But I'm trying to get in touch with my relational side. So I was a little embarrassed and uneasy about it. But I said, well, I'm doing just fine, hoping that it would die right there. And the other person says, so what are you up to? What kind of question is that, you know? I said, well, just like you, I'm just traveling. And, I'm getting kind of nervous here, and I'm wanting to get out of this thing as quick as I can. And then I hear another question. He says, can I come over? I'm like, what? This is getting just too weird. But I still want to be polite, you know, and be relational and all that stuff. So I figure, okay, I got to end this and get out of this as quick as I can. So I say, I'm a little busy right now. Thinking, you know, that should be it. And then I hear the other person over in the other stall say rather nervously, listen, I'm going to have to call you back. There's some idiot in the other stall that just keeps answering all my questions. So, don't you love cell phones? So, by the way, if you have a cell phone with you, turn it off. We don't want any embarrassing, weird conversations here. All right, let's dive in. We're going to talk about judging tonight. Matthew chapter 7, the Sermon on the Mount. And if you have your Bible, open it up. You can just leave it open to that portion of Scripture. We'll be coming back to chapter 6 in a few minutes. But I want to start out by reading this. Matthew chapter 7. Verses 1 through 6. Jesus speaking says, do not judge, or you too will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged, and with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when all the time there's a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take out the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Kind of an interesting few verses there, isn't it? He says very clearly, hard to miss it, do not judge or you will be judged. What does he mean by that? The word for judge is the Greek word krino. And it has three very distinctive uses throughout the New Testament. I thought it'd be good for us to look at some examples of how it's used. Number one, in Titus chapter 3, verse 12, Paul is writing and he says, as soon as I send Artemis and Tychus to you, do your best to come to me at Nicopolis, because I have decided, I have krino, to winter there. And this is a pretty typical usage of the word, and it simply means to decide, to distinguish, to discern, or to resolve. It essentially means to make a decision about something, to distinguish left from right, right from wrong, truth from error, light from dark, that kind of thing. Now, do you think Jesus is telling us there, whatever you do, don't make any decisions? Because if you do, somebody's liable to make a decision about you. It's probably not how he's using the word, is it? The second use is found in John 18:31. Pilate speaking says about Jesus, take him yourself and judge him by your own law. And so the second use of krino refers to a courtroom setting. It refers to judging something legal, a legal matter, in a court of law. Now, do you think Jesus is saying that we should do away with the court systems? Probably not. Probably not the way he is using the word here. But the third usage of it, the third example, is 1 Corinthians 4:5. Paul is writing here and he says, therefore, judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. At that time, each man will receive praise from God. This third use of the word krino It is, first of all, it's something that only God does. This is God's prerogative alone because it involves exposing the darkest recesses and the motives of a person's heart. Another example of this type of use is John 7:24. It says, "Stop judging by mere appearances and make a right judgment." Stop judging. That's the third way that the word is used, according to external appearance, but judge in the first sense of the word with proper judgment. And I would suggest that Paul is saying here in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, that he's saying, stop making judgments about the dark recesses and motives of people based on appearances, but rather it's okay to make some decisions about their actions. Don't make those kinds of calls about the hidden parts of the person's heart and their motives based on what you see, based on their actions only. Now go back to Matthew 7. What is Jesus talking about? Well, I don't think he's saying don't make decisions. That would be ridiculous. We have to make decisions all the time. I don't think he's saying get rid of the court systems. In fact, the Bible sanctions the judicial systems and law and government. I think what he's referring to here is speaking of a way in which we evaluate or critique or criticize and draw conclusions about the very essence, the motives, the hidden recesses of the heart of other people. The way to judge the way Jesus is talking about here is to make an evaluation or to draw some conclusions about another person's inmost being or their value, their worth. And to judge in this way is to confuse actions with essence and identity. And that is God's job. It's not our job. So a person, for example, does something wrong or dishonest or hurts you or maybe is destructive. And from their actions, which we, I think, can legitimately draw, you know, we can discern right from wrong with about their actions. But we take it another step and we make statements, we make judgments, we make some kind of a judgment call about their essence, about their identity, about their worth as a person, something much deeper than just making a call about their action. We don't just say, you know that thing that you did? That was wrong. That was messed up. Instead, we say, you are messed up. At the core of who you are is a wreck. You're messed up. And there's a big difference between those two things. Judging people that way very subtly diminishes the person's value and in the same breath elevates us. It lowers them and elevates us. And so we move from determinations about their actions, that external way of using the word, number one, to value statements about who they essentially are in their inmost being and their motives, the third use. So in essence, to judge the way Jesus is talking about here in Matthew 7 is to take on that divine responsibility for evaluating the value and the motives of another person. Now we are assuming God's job and seeing it as our job now to expose the motives of that person's heart. And when we do that, we're playing God, and we're acting way above our pay grade. But then Jesus does something kind of weird. He follows this with a section now in which he starts drawing in planks and sawdust and dogs and pigs. And, you know, it kind of makes you wonder, what is the connection between judging, you know, do not judge lest you be judged, and these planks and specks and pigs and dogs? Follow my train of thought here, because I think it will all fall together and make some sense. Judging, if you break it all down and strip all the layers away, is really essentially about control and manipulation. Judging makes people less than us and attempts to conform them to our agenda through, you know, correcting them, criticizing them, maybe shaming them, put downs. We might even ostracize them, give them the cold shoulder or shun them or speak negatively about them to other people or even to them. Judging is an attempt for me to get you to see just how flawed you are. And it goes unsaid just by comparison how wonderful I am, how much better I am than you. And it tries to get the other person to do something that better suits my purpose. Now, think about parents. I mean, maybe many of you have experienced this, where they use shame to control their children. You know, why do you always do that? You know, they're carping and harping all the time. Why don't you ever do X? Why can't you be like your brother? Do you know any kid who responds to shame with, wow, now that I feel totally like crap, I think I'll do better. I'm going to change. It doesn't work that way, does it? It does. Shame and criticizing and this constant badgering does not motivate anybody to change. In fact, we'll see that it actually many times has the opposite effect. Jesus says, do not judge. And then he paints this picture of someone walking around with this big timber in their eye, trying to move sawdust from another's eye. We might be able to illustrate it like this. Mark, you know, I got to talk to you. You got a little dust in your eye. Can I help you with it? You know, I mean, you are really totally messed up. And I've got it down pretty good. And I think I can help. What do you say? You know, I mean, you're such a wreck. I mean, what the heck, you know? You know, that's what he's saying. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous. But I think he goes to the ridiculous because it's pretty hard to miss his point, isn't it? That we would even have the audacity to suggest that somebody has this little flaw here and we've got this great big timber sticking out of our head and we have the ability to fix them. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Rob Bell pointed out this connection that I honestly had never seen before. And you got to go back to the context to see this connection. Back to Matthew 6. This is what we typically call the Lord's Prayer. And it's really a model prayer for followers of Jesus to model their prayers after. And in verse 9 there, he starts this out with the words, "Our Father in heaven, holy is your name." Now, this is a model prayer that, you know, it's kind of like, this is how you pray. You know, this is a pretty good way to pray. And when he says this, our Father in heaven, it's really a very subtle way of acknowledging the idea that there is an entire unseen realm around us that really shapes everything. We've been talking about this all year, about it all belongs to God and how that nothing is random. God is going somewhere. We don't see it all the time, but he is moving very purposely and very determinedly in a direction. And that's kind of what he's alluding to here. This is a subtle acknowledgement that our lives are more than just what we experience with our senses. Our Father in heaven. There's another realm out there. It's just not my Father here on earth. It's just not the things that I can interact with my senses. But there's another realm out there. And it's a recognition of the fact that we are physical, for sure, but we are also spiritual. Everything is connected and driven by this unseen spiritual realm. And we pray like that, it's acknowledging that we are spiritual beings made in the image of God. And for us to ignore that spiritual part of who we are, and to just live in the realm of the senses and the material, is to ignore the very foundation of who we are as people created in the image of God. Then he goes on in the prayer and he says, forgive us our sins. That is laying our past before God. And give us today our daily bread, laying our present before God. And deliver us from evil, laying our future before God. And this prayer very, very beautifully and succinctly encompasses the totality of our lives. That's why he says, this is a good way to pray. It doesn't miss anything. The past, deals with our forgiveness. It brings in the present, our need for bread, for material provision. We need those things. And our future needs, our need for guidance, and our need for deliverance. And at the core of this prayer, in fact, the whole point of, I think, what he's teaching on the Sermon on the Mount, is that he's trying to get us to entrust ourselves completely to God. Acknowledge that there is a spiritual realm that is foundational to all of life, and entrust ourselves completely to God. He's inviting us to learn how to do that so that we will not live full of anxiety and worry. So that we would learn to allow God to be the anchor, to be the rock, to be the unshakable foundation upon which our lives are built. He's inviting us, as Rob Bell says, to take a deep breath kind of perspective on life. Let the tension go. Let it go. Give yourself fully to God. Whatever tension you brought in here with you, whatever conflict might be eating away at you, Jesus' invitation to you is to become a person who is like a tree planted beside living water. Jeremiah 17, 7 and 8. Blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. He will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when the heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. See, when that is the way our lives, when our lives go deep into God, and we become, when our roots run deep, even though, like that tree, we may sway violently when the fierce winds of life beat us up, they do not break us. It'll thrash us. We'll feel it, but it won't break us. He's inviting us to be like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on a rock. When the flood came, the torrent struck that house but could not shake it because it was well built. It had a solid, unshakable foundation. And he's inviting us to a way of living in a messed up, broken world that very few people, even very Christian people, experience. Even though we know the language, we have lots of memory verses in our mind, we have the right bumper stickers on our cars, we may even hold positions of Christian leadership, many of us, in reality, are very anxious, worried people. And Jesus is inviting his followers to live with a simple, humble trust that we're going to be all right because God is in charge. Now, it's a real simple lesson to grasp. It's a real simple lesson to talk about, but it's a tough one to do and to do consistently. It's something that I struggle with constantly, and I think you probably do too. Well, then he traces what happens when you fail to entrust yourself to God. In chapter 6, verse 25, he says, therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Now, worry can be kind of a good thing. Anxiety can be a good thing because it's kind of like a warning bell. Ding, 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 ding. When you find yourself worrying excessively about what you're going to eat, drink, or wear, or your 401 becoming a 2, that kind of stuff, it's a good sign that you have not fully entrusted yourself to God, who can take care of the birds and the flowers, he says, and he can also take care of you. So when you feel that, that tension, that anxiety, just use it like a warning bell and take that, let go of it. Entrust yourself to God. And he's telling us what it looks like not to entrust ourselves to God. We will be racked with worry and anxiety if we hang on to that. Now, at the end of this worry section, chapter 6, verse 34, he goes into the do not judge section. And at first glance, you might wonder what worrying about what I'm going to eat, drink, or wear has to do with judging. I mean, how are the two connected? What are they related to? In reality, it has an awful lot to do with it. His point that he is stressing throughout these sections here is, number one, there's two things that he's really stressing. When he talks about the prayer, in that prayer section, he's really stressing for us to entrust ourselves to God. What you will eat, drink, and wear. The things that we need to live. Give yourself to God. Entrust yourself to God so that you can live free of worry and anxiety. And if you don't, you will be racked with worry and anxiety. But when he gets into this judging section, I think he makes a little subtle shift from entrusting ourselves to God to entrusting others to God. And I think he's saying there, don't play God. Let him be God and let him judge the person's value and motives. Let him be God and let him bring that other person to maturity. And if you do not entrust others to God, if you don't entrust yourself to God, you're going to be racked with worry and anxiety. If you do not trust others to God, you will be plagued by a desire to control them. And in all probability, you will become very judgmental and critical. And then he says something that really sounds strange and makes you wonder why it's there. Do not give dogs what is sacred. Do not throw your pearls to pigs. If you do, they may trample them under their feet and then turn and tear you to pieces. Now, what is the connection there? What do dogs and pigs and pearls have to do with planks and judging and all this other stuff? I mean, it's like, what? You know, gee, I was just wondering about that. You know, he said, the command there, do not throw your pearls to pigs. Now, how many of you have ever been tempted to throw pearls at pigs? Anybody here? Blackwell. Okay, good, good. At least you're honest. You know, has this been a big problem for any of you? Oh, man, maybe we need to start another overcomers group because so many of you have this compulsion to throw your pearls to pigs. I mean, was this a problem back then? I mean, was this a thing that people regularly did? Were a lot of people taking pearls and throwing them out to pigs? Probably not. I think he's trying to, again, like with the plank and the speck, illustrate a point. A pearl is a good thing. It's a precious thing. It's a valuable thing. And I think that he is talking about taking good things, things that are sacred, pearls, and throwing them or giving them to pigs. And the issue is, that I think he's really stressing, is that a pig or a dog is unable to appreciate the good thing and receive it. They're unclean, they're base, they're unable to receive and appreciate those good things. They are only able to trample them underfoot. Do you know people like that? Are you a person like that? A pig essentially says about a pearl, what am I supposed to do with this? And it is of no value to the pig, and so it just tramples it underfoot, heading back to the mud. Now, again, remember the context here. He's teaching us entrust ourselves to God. And when we don't, we'll know it because we'll be plagued with worry and anxiety. But he's also teaching us to entrust others to God. And when we don't trust others to God, then we're going to end up trying to control or manipulate them. Sometimes we just out and out try to control. We try to get people to behave the way we want them to. And that's, I think that's the main shot that he's giving us there in 7:1. That we do it by judging them, by shaming them, by criticizing them, maybe even, you know, giving them the cold shoulder until they comply with what we want and with our desires. I mean, sometimes it's just a full-on frontal assault. We go after them, judging and criticizing them. But sometimes, and I think here's where it makes a subtle shift with the pearls, we try to control people through good things. Do you know anybody who grew up in a Christian home, you know, went to Sunday school, learned all the Bible stories, went to Christian camps, youth group, maybe even mission trips, did all of that stuff. And then when they hit 18, they totally walk away from the faith. You know, that is a fairly typical story of missionary and pastor kids. It happens all the time. Now, a pearl, you see, could be even the Christian faith. And when it is shoved down someone's throat who's not ready to receive it, or when it's enforced with harsh legalism like many missionary and pastors do, because, you know, our reputation's on the line, this kid acts up, it's going to look bad on me. And we become overly demanding parents, the good thing can become a bad thing. Maybe the pearl might be a family relationships. You know, the father has no time for his kids, and then he wakes up one day, usually later in life, and realizes, wow, my relationship with my kids is very important after all. And so he starts to get it right. And you know, he goes to the kids, hey, I see it. I'm going to go for it. You know, wow, let's have a relationship. And they're basically, sorry, Dad, that train left the station a long time ago. They have no time for you and no use for you. Kind of reminds me of Harry Chapin's song, Cats in the Cradle. Sorry, it's gone. It's over. You blew it. Or the perfectionist parent who constantly rode their kids about their failings and their faults and is going to bludgeon them into perfection. Maybe you've seen a little softer approach. Maybe you've seen families where someone showers somebody else with gifts, with pearls, and the other person doesn't want it and doesn't want anything to do with them. And may even respond violently to the giver. And as you observe and as they observe, it's like, wow, I don't get this, you know, this reaction to my generosity. I was just trying to help. Well, maybe they're reacting against a perceived manipulation and control tactics that were characteristic of their past. You see, when we do not entrust others to God, here's something that we really have to get our heads around too. We can live with a profound anxiety and tension over how to get them to do what we want. I mean, sometimes that's really a genuinely good thing. But a lot of times when they're not going with the program, they're not going with the flow, it creates this deep tension and anxiety in us. And we try and try and try to get them to play by the rules, but you know, sometimes the rules are more about us than they are about God's rules. And sometimes when they don't go along with it, we just do a frontal assault and we treat them negatively and we judge them. Other times we take a softer approach and we try to manipulate them into compliance by showering them with things that they aren't ready for or not appreciative of. And he's not saying there that you shouldn't train your kids, discipline your kids, or that you shouldn't give or serve people or be a good neighbor, any of those things. He's warning us that when we experience such a deep-seated anxiety over the behavior of another person now, it may not be us and them, it may be about us not entrusting ourselves and the other person to God. It could be another one of those warnings that, wait a minute, you're trying to play God here. It's not your job. See, when you sense anxiety because another person isn't going along with your desires, it's time to look in the mirror and see if there's a plank in there somewhere. Your pearls may also be just that. They may be a good thing. And it may just be that the person is not able to appreciate it or just isn't ready to receive it. But the negative reaction to your good thing may be because there is in there somewhere some kind of unhealthy string attached that they can feel and they react against. And sometimes they react very forcefully. So you see, we got to be looking in the mirror. We got to be checking our motives. We got to be looking in our own eyes before we try to take the specks out of others' eyes. You might have to look in the mirror and see if there's a plank there somewhere. And you have to be discerning. You have to use that judgment in the good sense of the word and say, is that person just not ready for this? Okay, back off. Or are they sensing something impure in my motives coming from me? You know, this is not just a good lesson on judging. It's a pretty good lesson on codependence too, I find. It really speaks to a lot of issues that we deal with. Well, let me give you a few things, three things specifically that you can take away with you. First of all, entrusting ourselves and others to God is the only way we will be able to help anybody. See, that's step one. That is fundamental and foundational. Now, and it could be easy to conclude from this passage that we should never try to speak into another person's life or try to help them with problems that we observe them struggling with, or we should never try to offer correction to another person. But look at verse 5. Jesus says, you hypocrite, first, underline that in your Bible or in your notes, first, take the plank out of your own eye, and then, you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. He's not teaching you to look the other way, to ignore it when you see trouble in another person, to ignore the specks when you see others that you see in others. He's saying, first, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will be able to help someone else. You actually can be the kind of person who can help people. But it begins by doing the hard work of taking our own moral inventory first, in which we examine the motives of our own hearts first. And then we are able to help someone else. And the place to begin is to ask God, do I have any planks in my eye? And then surrender them to God as He shows them. Secondly, give up the illusion of control. This is kind of a tough one to do too. Accept the reality that you cannot control anybody. And you know, if we were honest, we would probably all have to admit that we have our hands full even controlling ourselves, much less taking on the extra job of controlling somebody else. You cannot control another person. They have a free will and are ultimately going to do what they're going to do. Parents, especially those with little children right now, you're going to understand that someday. As soon as your kids get big enough that you cannot lift them and put them where you want them, then it will become very clear you cannot control them. And that what you thought was controlling before was only an illusion. They're going to do what they're going to do. You can teach, you can lead, you can influence, you can encourage, but you cannot make them do anything. You cannot control them. Maybe a better way to start a conversation with somebody that you would like to help would be something like, you know, I can't make you do anything. And I realize that I could talk my lips off, and you're going to walk out of here and do whatever you want to do anyway. You control your behavior, and you are responsible for the decisions you make. So now that we've cleared that up, can I help? That's really what he's saying here. Is there someone that you've been trying to get to do something, and they just won't go with the program? Jesus says, if you want to help them, you have to start with your own sense of powerlessness, your own sense of brokenness, and you have to entrust yourself to God and then entrust them to God, and then maybe you'll be able to help them with their issues. And you know what? Here's the thing. There is a certain freedom about doing this. When you give up the God complex and you really come to grips with the fact that you're not God, you are not in charge, you cannot control them, it really does set you free. And even though you love this person deeply and you'd be willing to do anything for them, you have to first acknowledge that they are free to do whatever they want. And you have to be willing to live with the tension that creates within us. You do have to learn to live with that, because you can see clearly that they're heading for a train wreck. I mean, I'm speaking from experience. I've raised three teenagers. You see the train wreck coming so clear, it's like the beam in your eye. And there's not a thing you can do about it. And you have to come to grips with, I cannot control this. I'm going to give myself to God, and I'm going to give them to God and let Him work it out with them. That's really all I can do anyway. And instead of talking your lips off, trying to cajole them into going along with your program, you can talk your lips off to God and see if you can get Him to intervene on their behalf. That would be the more productive thing. You know, stop and think. How did you get to where you are today in your relationship with God? I'm sure you're like me, man. It was just a smooth sailing straight road. No turns, no detours, no chuck holes, right? Oh, you guys had trouble? Wow. Well, you know, if God was able to get you here from where you were, don't you think He's able to get your kids or your friends or your spouse, your loved ones there too? You know, and by the way, the journey isn't over yet for us, for you, for me. So don't get prideful over what amounts to little baby steps, okay, in your relationship with God. When we're controlling, we make it about us and them. When we entrust our own lives to God and then entrust them to God, then we make it about them and God. And that's what it's about anyway. Last of all, when you set yourself up as a judge of the motives and the darkest recesses of another person's heart, you really are setting yourself up for the same treatment. When you put yourself in God's position over others, you're setting yourself up for the same treatment. He says, do not judge or you will be judged. Now, he doesn't say, by the way, God will get you. I find that idea somewhat difficult to reconcile with what I read about grace in the Bible, but I do remember a thing we call the principle of the harvest. You reap what you sow. And I think that's what he's referring here. If you are a judgmental person and you raise yourself up by lowering others, if you are controlling and worrying and anxious, a person who is constantly critiquing and condemning and judging, it's going to come back around and bite you. It will come back to haunt you. That's what he's saying. It will turn on you and tear you to pieces. You're going to be miserable. Remember that section about worry and anxiety? If you're cajoling and judging in that to try to get people to comply and they don't do it, guess what? You're going to be the poster child for worry and anxiety. You are going to be miserable. It's going to come back and bite you. Jesus is teaching us that we can profoundly help other people if we will take an honest inventory of our own lives and surrender the planks that we find there to God. We can profoundly help other people if we will allow God to do His job. Our job is to humbly, with no strings attached, speak truthfully to one another about our struggles and about our faults, and together entrust ourselves to God. See, this whole thing is about four things: control, judging through judging. Judging is about control. Manipulating to get people to do what we want through the gifts, the pearls that we throw at them. Recognizing a person's inability or ability to receive our good things. And letting go if they won't. Not playing God. Let's pray. Lord, again, my prayer is that You would complete, that You would see the work that You've begun in us all the way through to completion. And I pray that we would remember that we are projects that are still under construction. And that we would extend the same graces and the same support to other projects that God is working on around us and in our families. May we not just go along to get along, But instead, may we be courageous and speak the truth to one another with humility and love, recognizing that we are pretty flawed too, so that ultimately we all may reach maturity together. Amen. Don't forget the tables back there. Ushers, would you come and receive the offering from our church family? And remember, we have a secure website if that is a more convenient way for you to give. God bless you. Thanks for coming tonight.